Have you ever looked into the night sky and wondered, are we alone? We've learned so much about the world and our universe, and yet we realize there are so many mysteries yet unsolved. If you are interested in the unexplained and mysterious in our world, then join us in The Night Search, a forum for discussion and exploration of the world just beyond our reach. And now, your host for Night Search, Eddie Middleton.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Justin. Eddie will be here with us shortly. I'm having some technical issues. Just one second, folks. Eddie, are you there?
I'm here.
All right, Eddie, we're
Hello?
Live. I do apologize. I just had
I'm online. We have a technical problem. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. We're live now, and go for it, Eddie.
All right. I don't know what happened. I couldn't get on. I was there listening. We're here interviewing Joe Fex. He's been a guest on Night Search many times, actually, going back quite a few years now. And he's one of the most knowledgeable persons you'll ever want to listen to on the subject of ufology, Bigfoot research, and all kinds of other paranormal things, including ghosts. And he's a phenomenal person with the kind of information he has at his fingertips. Joe, thanks for being on Night Search again, and I'm looking forward to another lively show. It always is. We have you as a guest.
Yeah, he's not here just yet. I have to call him in. Like I said, I've been having some issues.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Nuts. So I do apologize. I'm trying to get him in right now.
Okay.
Bear with me. And
we are indeed, sir. You got the number 303, right?
Yes, I have his number. I will
653. Yeah, 5069.
Anybody there yet?
Yeah, Joe, you hear me? Okay.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just perfectly. I've already introduced you. And
yeah,
we're ready to.
I could hear you guys a moment ago, but you guys been.
We were having some technical problems there, with
yep.
It's not on our end, I don't think. But as long as you can hear us and we can hear you, we're ready to go now. So
yeah, sounds like we're ready.
We got a lot of people listening tonight, I think. Just to start out. I wanted to talk to you about the phenomenon of the disappearing people in the national parks, which David Politis has documented in, like, I think his fourth book now, the Missing 411 series. Of course, you've been following this pretty closely yourself. You've met him in person when he spoke out in Colorado, not last year sometime, I think it was. And this has been pretty well covered up, and the general public just hasn't heard about this. They don't realize, you know, the seriousness of this and the extent of it in the national parks. And we're not talking about just people, you know, disappearing, you know, which, you know, not found, but in the normal course of events, that does happen, and the conventional explanations of that. We're talking about cases that we could call, you know, in the category of high strangeness. And there's one case in particular you were telling me about last week you didn't mention before on the show. It just spooked me. I would like you to tell us about that. And that's typical of these other cases that he's documented, his 411, missing 411. The guy in Michigan, the young man.
Yeah. Colin Finnerty?
Yeah.
Yeah, Colin Finnerty was, I guess this happened maybe about a year or so ago. So early 2013, I think, or 2013, but either way, it's a real staple case for Pilates research, primarily because the victim that was killed, he disappeared, and then he was later found dead 2 days later in contact with other people through his cell phone as he was being pursued. So that in itself sets it far apart from all the other cases that he's had, because I don't think I've seen one of these cases where that's happened before, where a person was actually in contact with people outside, and law enforcement was attempting to locate him through his cell phone and trying to track that. And it's one of those things that just defies any explanation. The guy was young. He was healthy. He was very athletic. He was over 230, 240 pounds, you know, over 6 feet tall. This was a big guy, you know, and he was a former football player and just had a really strong reputation with everybody he knew as being just a really powerful guy and with a very fearless attitude. The guy was not easy to intimidate at all. And
let me ask you, Joe, why was he out there by himself to begin with, though?
Well, he was actually out there with his girlfriend or wife, with his better half and a couple of friends. And towards the evening, he wanted to go back out and get one more round of fishing in. And so they helped him out with the boat. They put him out, and when he was supposed to be back, he never showed back up. I think he was supposed to be back around 9 o'clock, and they were going to pack it in from there, and he didn't show up. And then at some point after that, as everybody is starting to get concerned, because he's normally, you know, the kind of guy that if he says he's going to be there, he's going to be there. It was at that point that he called the girlfriend or the wife on the cell phone. And according to her, he was in a panic. Something was really upsetting and stressing him out. And he mentioned that there were people pursuing him. Somebody was following him or shadowing him or stalking him, even stating that it was about 20 feet away from him.
Wow.
But I don't know if he defined exactly what it was. I mean, one would think if it's 20 feet away from you, even in thick foliage, it's, you know, it's fairly easy at 20 feet to see, you know, what's 20 feet away from you. You know, if
yeah.
you have a bear 20 feet, mountain lion, another person, whatever, you know, unless you're like in really dense underbrush, you know, or like a jungle environment, like down in Florida or Louisiana, you know, I've seen areas in those places now that were so dense with growth that you couldn't see 10 feet in front of you. You literally just couldn't see in front of you because it was just all blocked by, you know, all these vines and different undergrowth. But in Michigan, I was raised for the most part in Michigan, and there are very few places. There's thickets that I know of that are really dense and really hard to get through, but there's only certain points in the summer when they're the spring and summer where they're so thick they're hard to see through, you know. You can usually
yeah.
over them. They don't get that tall in most areas. So knowing the environment in Michigan as I do, and I've hung out in the woods, I can't tell you how many times in Michigan is where I developed my first taste for that, you know, camping and all that kind of stuff. Michigan is just a fantastic place to go camping. There's just waterways everywhere, ponds, rivers, streams, you name it. It's just a fantastic place. If you're a hunter, you know, Michigan is like a paradise.
They call it land of the lakes, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just a matter of general, you know, ecological fundamentals. You know, if you have a lot of water, you're going to have a lot of growth. You're going to have a lot of growth. You're going to have a lot of wildlife, a lot of different birds, a lot of different animals. You know, it's just a rich environment for a good balanced environment for just breeding wildlife. You know,
yeah, Joe, before you go further, I think it might be good at this point just to bring up an incident where you and Chuck Schakowsky were out looking for Bigfoot in a remote wilderness area and felt like you were being stalked by possibly Bigfoot, but you didn't know that for certain, I guess. Now, in retrospect, and you can look back and possibly think may have been a similar thing pursuing you and Chuck.
Yeah, it definitely gives you something to consider. Number one, this was right in the heart of one of Pilates areas here in Colorado. And here in Colorado, this is a fairly frequent phenomenon. I think last year we had at least six that fell into the criteria of what separates it from an accidental thing or whatever, you know, and to, you know, something that's a little bit more difficult to digest. And It was in the Roosevelt National Forest. I can't state the exact location, but it's a place that I had been monitoring for well over 12 years. And on the perimeter of this outland, it's literally wilderness. You know, there's the state parks that everybody's familiar with and where you go hiking and camping and rock climbing and do all these things. And you're going to, you know, climb to the top of mountains and all this kind of stuff. But then we have national forests that have a central wilderness in them that, you know, human beings just have not been in hundreds of years. You know, the only way to get in there is by foot or by helicopter. And most people, you know, don't have a helicopter laying around, you know. Yeah. But the point is it's extremely rugged, and unless you are rugged, you are not going in there, you know. No vehicles, no horses, nothing. I mean, there's just nothing to get into these areas with. You pretty much have to hoof it and climb it, and it's really treacherous. And
the two of you were in search of a Bigfoot, right?
Well, I had gotten a report from a gentleman out here that had an odd experience. He wasn't into the paranormal. He wasn't into Bigfoot. He really didn't know a lot about that kind of stuff. He was a Vietnam vet, really an amazing guy. He's one of the people that you meet a lot of people doing this kind of stuff, and most of the time they're people that you wish you didn't meet, you know. This guy, I was actually really proud to meet him, and we went out, we briefed him, we let him know what we were interpreting from the data. But the story goes, him and his wife had lost his 11-year-old son just a year and a half before. And then their daughter, who was, I think, 15 or 16, had come down with a chronic disease that was slowly killing her. And when I met them, she was in the catatonic state. She was awake, she was conscious, but she couldn't move, she couldn't speak, she couldn't even blink her eyes. And, you know, it was just a matter of time, you know, before they would lose her too. So the man was really, you know, a really distraught part of his life, him and his wife both. And they were struggling to understand this, you know. And he lived at the foothills of the Roosevelt National Forest, and he would go on walks and hikes and get away from everything to just kind of be alone, you know, and think about things. And he went out to do this one day and go meditate in the woods for a few hours. And he found an old mining trail that led him to an ancient long gone mining camp. But you can still see where there used to be camp buildings and where they used to skin the deer. You can see it all, what used to be on that land, you know.
Right.
And some kind of mining operation took place there maybe 180, 190 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And just the shadow remnants remained. And he had passed that, and he had started up and did some rock climbing. And on his way back out, the same path that he got in with, and mind you, this is like a hidden path. There's no population around this area, you know.
Uh-huh.
And this path only existed because of mining cars and horses and burros and things like this that were coming in and out of this camp
right.
So long ago. And as he comes out, as soon as he hits the clearing by where the camp used to be, there's a tree laying across the trail, like somebody put it there to block his path. And he got this really bizarre, uneasy feeling that, you know, he was a Vietnam combat veteran. So you're talking a guy that's very much in tune with his environment and very much in tune with his instincts. If you've ever, you know, associated yourself with people from that era. And it unnerved him. It unsettled him. He had never felt like that before.
Yeah,
and it was intimidating, and it was something that was foreign and just completely uncomfortable for him. And so he was mentioning this to a friend, and that friend happened to know me and called me up and said, "Hey, you know, this guy just told me something that I think might interest you. Is it okay if I give him your number?" I said, sure, have him give me a call. And he explained it all to me in detail. And I said, you know what, can we come out, we go through this step by step, you know. Mm. And we did that, went out there. Every step he took along the path, he took us by and showed us the tree that was laying there. It was still there, but it had been moved to the side of the trail. He didn't move it. He just stepped over it, you know, when he came out of the mountain, like a week or so previous. And but at some point, something came along and picked it up again and laid it alongside parallel to the trail. You know, it wasn't like a moose or an elk shoving this thing over, or was maybe, you know, scratching their horns onto it or anything like that. It was obviously deliberately picked up and moved in a very neat and orderly way. You know, it was uncanny. And
was it a heavy limb? A heavy limb? Or tree?
It was a tree. It was a dead tree that had been broken off at the trunk. It hadn't rotted at the trunk. It was broken off. That was one thing that we noticed about it. It was a little odd. That was maybe 15 feet long, maybe 10 inches thick. Nothing that you'd have to like break out the lumberjack hatchets and chainsaws with, you know what I mean? But certainly something that a normal person wouldn't just go walking around carrying, you know.
It was a little
obtrusive. It wasn't so big that one person couldn't pick up one end and move it off the trail, you know.
Okay.
But like I wouldn't be able to pick up the whole thing. You know, you'd have to have two people on either end to pick it up in one piece. And we couldn't see anything in the grass, anywhere where it had been dragged, or any evidence of branches and parts of it coming off as it's being dragged through an area, or anything that's being broken down as it's being dragged through an area. It looked like it was picked up and neatly set there. Not rolled there, not dragged there, not nothing. It was just placed there. So...
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, you try not to jump to conclusions. You try to rationalize these things and look at every available option. You know, there is a possibility that somebody is out there. Who would be out there? We have no idea. This is an uninhabited stretch of land that borders a completely prehistoric, huge expanse of wilderness that no one ever goes to, you know. And it's also mountain lion capital of the world. So you have to be really careful in these areas. You got to really know what you're doing. You got to know how to read animal signs, smell animal scents, know what their dens look like, you know. And I scouted ahead for mountain lion because most of the climb was almost completely vertical, up nothing but rock. And you would climb up maybe 40, 50 feet, and then you would hit a ledge big enough to stand on, and then you climb over the next rock and keep going up and keep going up until we reached the top of the mountain, which was about 12,000-13,000 feet. And it's real easy to accidentally, the rock you're climbing on could be a mountain lion den. And God help you, there could be cubs in that den, and that mother knows it, you are screwed.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Mountain lion in front of you that's all pissed off, and nothing behind you but 400 feet of nothing but rock. So, really, really bad. So it was important, when you do these things, it's important that you have people that are strategically designed to take take command of a certain duty of the team. You know what I mean? And one of those duties is to scout ahead for problems, you know, potential problems. And usually the person in the crew that knows the most about a certain aspect is the one that leads that portion of the crew. You know, the person with the most forensic knowledge is the person that's gathering samples, you know, so on and so forth, and carrying medical supplies and things like that. You know, so you each person has a general ability for all aspects of the expedition, but they also have specialties. So each different person has a different specialty. And that's usually how we try to keep it designed. And
so it was you and Chuck Jaskowski and the gentleman who had first encountered this obstruction
right.
in his path.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And we rarely ever take anybody out with us unless they are trained people. unless they are like emergency personnel. You know, somebody with background like firemen would take a fireman any day. We know they got all the medical training, you know, and emergency training. But there's certain things that, you know, you want the people that are with you to be really well adept and really intelligent and really responsible and know what to do and not easily rattled. And, you know, because people don't realize how easy it is to get hurt, how easy it is to die out there, how easy it is to get lost, how easy it is for, you know, an ice storm to hit you out of the clear blue.
So we take it really
seriously when we do these things. Now, the first parallel to this Pilates research is we had two people with us that were not, they were not researchers. They were not field expeditioners. And one was an interested party that was a friend of mine that was interested in getting in training for this kind of stuff. So he wanted a little taste of it. And the other one was our witness. But our witness had, you know, tactical training. You know, he was very, very well trained in Vietnam. And, you know, we knew he was equipped mentally, physically, you know, that the guy was, he was a survivalist. You know, him and his wife live on the outskirts of civilization, you know, not because they have to, but because that's where they're comfortable.
Uh-huh.
You know, they like rough living, you know, and all of that was really apparent. So as we're going along, we're kind of like lecturing these two guys step by step, everything that we're doing, everything we're about to do, what we anticipate, and the whole nine yards, you know. So we're like taking this opportunity to give these guys a crash course, hands-on in the field training for Bigfoot research. You know, and the signs that you're going to look for, the tracks you're going to look for, the environment you're going to look for, the things that are the most common when you lump all these Bigfoot reports together. You take all those things that are absolutely extremely common. Those are your distinguishable facts, and go off of those ones, you know. And so we reached this area at about 9,000-10,000 feet where it leveled off a bit. And it's starting to drizzle rain. When we left in the foothills, by the way, it was 75 degrees, sun was shining, not a cloud in the sky. Weather could not have been more perfect. It wasn't hot, it wasn't cold. It was and so that's what it was when we started out. Well, once we got to about 9,000-10,000 feet, it became overcast. Started a light sprinkle, like a mist, started to fall, right?
Uh-huh.
And we're lecturing them further and further, and we're telling them the pitfalls of, you know, one of your worst enemies in the wilderness environment is going to be weather, and weather, and how it can just hit you out of nowhere. And it was like the higher we climbed up these rocks and the further we pushed into that range, the more it was raining. It was absolutely bizarre. It was like every step of the way, the further we pushed, the harder the rain got. We pushed further through the rain. Then it started snowing. We pushed further through the rain and snow. Then it started hailing. When we got to the top of the mountain, it started lightning. You know? And it was like we had a drama department working for us or something, you know? It was like something out of a movie. And Chuck and I, we really didn't think much of it at the time. But now, you know, after I've seen a lot of this David Pilates work, you know, that is one of the uncanny aspects of this that thrusts it into the paranormal realm, is there is a distinguishable, distinct pattern of weather manipulation that is occurring and coinciding with these people disappearing that has every appearance that it is designed to prevent people from finding that person.
Ah.
And it is uncanny. Just read one of these books, and I'm serious. You will see this dozens of times. And that it just can't be accidental. And these are unpredicted storms. These are not, you know, it's going to snow tonight, and then somebody goes missing, and then it snows tonight. You're talking the same scenario to where the weather's just perfect, couldn't be more perfect, everything is fine, and then just everything goes wrong. Suddenly your kid's gone. He was just 10 feet away from me. And, you know, you're going into a panic, and as soon as they start searching, clouds roll in, thunder rolls. It starts lightning, starts raining, sometimes so severely that a lot of these searches are literally hindered and canceled because the severe weather that has hit has just hit so powerfully and so abruptly that there's just no preparation. And you can't send a search team into a rugged area, you know, when they can't see 4 feet in front of them because of blinding snow.
Why do they want to get rid of some of these people? That's what I was curious.
What do you mean, get rid of?
Well, the people that are whatever doing all this, the weather and all this strange stuff. Why, if the end goal is to kill somebody, why do they want to do that?
We don't know that's the end goal. We don't know what we're dealing with, so we can't predict any intention, really. You know,
that's true.
And if we try to predict an intention from our perspective, they call that anthropomorphism, when you project your mentality onto another thing that does not have your mentality. It's something like
right. When
you look at your dog or your cat, you're constantly seeing your behavior in that dog and cat, and that's how you interpret it. But that's not how it really is, you know.
Right.
In some aspects, they are a lot like us, and they kind of think like us. But in most aspects, context of their thought is completely different from ours.
Completely different.
And so when you're dealing with something like aliens, or you're dealing with a topic like Bigfoot, or you're dealing with like the 411 research, this is an unknown. This is a
true thing
that we don't even have a clue. All we know is that it happens in and near hot spots. That has no way, shape, or form indicates that Bigfoot and UFOs are doing this. It's more indicating that this area has something unique about it in physics that we haven't discovered yet. And we need to be looking for that. We need to be looking for what is different here. You know, the granite fields, you know, and the granite boulders. There's a definite correlation between granite and this phenomenon. It comes up too much. It's like the same guy showing up at a house fire, showing up at 10 other house fires. Eventually, law enforcement and the fire department look at this guy.
As I say, they're going to...
are a little slim.
Right, yes.
Yeah. Oh, Joe, I was going to say, I want our listeners to understand, you're going to get back to the case in Michigan, but this was a parallel... such similarity that happened to you personally. The reason I want you to tell what happened here. So we reached the top.
We reached the top of this mountain, and sure enough, we find trees at the 9 and 10 foot level with the tops just a day prior twisted and pointed in a specific direction. We photographed all that. But we found what we were looking for, confirmation that this is Bigfoot territory.
Oh,
able to establish to this guy that more than likely that uneasy feeling you had and the reason that this tree was put across there is there's a Bigfoot out here, and it probably recognized your mood. It probably realized that you were upset, you know what I mean? And people didn't like that. Animals pick up your frequencies, you know, and people
are
like that aren't a threat. People that are out and in mourning and things like this. You know, it's like, you know, even in nature, even in wildlife, there's a level of reverence.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And when a mother cries for a lost or a devoured child, it's like all the other wildlife resonates with that, and they kind of leave them to their own. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
They all take respect to that and say, okay, we're not going to even gonna mess with this one. They got enough of their own trouble, you know? And, you know, who knows what the nature of it was, but at 10,000 feet, we found 200 and 300-pound boulders that had been
knocked out
of the ground. These are boulders that were 90% buried underground in dirt, in clay. And these things were plucked out of the ground. They weren't dug out. They were, like, popped right out of a hole and thrown 30 feet away from where they came from. And we were able to pick these boulders up and move them back to the holes in the ground and literally match them right up and definitively say, yeah, this boulder came from this hole. What in wildlife can pluck a boulder out of the ground like that, 200-300 pounds, and throw it 30 feet? We can see in the ground where it dented the ground, where it hit, from when it was thrown. We could see where it came out of, but we couldn't see any sign of any digging at all. No finger marks, no hoof marks, no nothing like that. It was weird. I've never seen that before. But we found like five of these boulders, ranging from 250 to about 340 pounds. You know, if they were any bigger, you know, it would have taken three of us to move them. It took two of us to pick one up and move it back to where it came from.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, and so we know that this was a Bigfoot area. And on our way out, once we got off the main peak of the mountain and made our way back to the stream that we followed in, we're walking down the stream and it's still snowing, still hailing, still raining all at the same time. We had decided at the top of the mountain, once the lightning and thunder started rolling in, we decided, okay, we need to evacuate. And it was perfect. It was like nature was narrating our lecture to these two guys in this crash course for expeditioning, you know?
Oh, my
and we're
goodness.
Like,
yes.
It was a perfect temperature. Temperature dropped to 37 degrees and then down to 34 degrees. And we were at the top of the mountain. We were able to demonstrate to them, you feel that tingling in your fingertips. You see how you're losing sensation. Now open your hand and close it real fast. You see how slow that is? Your joints are locking up. You're starting to seize. At this point, you need to be dry and out of the rain, or you will die. You'll get hypothermia, and your hands won't work, and you won't be able to climb out. You'll just sit up here and freeze. You know, so we were able to, like, really take them through, a living course in this stuff, and told them, at this point, you make the decision. If you can't find shelter, you evacuate. You get the hell off the mountain. And we got down, get back down to the stream, and the whole time we're hiking out of this, along this stream, I noticed that both of these guys, neither one of them are very fluent about Bigfoot. They know what Bigfoot is, you know, but they're not like into it. They're not into it like we are. But I noticed both of them kept looking to the right in a very paranoid way. So we stopped the line and I got them together and I said, because, you know, normally we're like 15, 20 feet apart. And I told them, I said, why are you looking over there? I don't know. Something over there is bothering me. I don't know. I don't see anything, but I get this bad feeling, and it's coming from over there. Now, Chuck and I knew that because we sensed it too, you know, but I didn't want to say anything until I wanted it to come out of them without any outside influence, you know.
Right.
So Chuck
yeah.
and I decided, you know, we figured, you know, there's something's out here with us, and we can't see it, we can't hear it, but we can sense it. So we told the other two guys, you know, keep along the stream. Stay ahead of us. And once you get like a quarter mile ahead of us, we'll give you that much time. We'll start back up on the trail. We'll shadow you back out, you know. And, you know, if there's any problems, you're still within yelling distance. And so Chuck and I had this idea that we were just going to fall back and let those guys go ahead and see if it would continue stalking those guys. So we can try to slip behind whatever it was that was shadowing us, that was giving us all that uneasy feeling. And we waited, and we didn't see anything, didn't hear anything, didn't see anything. So we started back along the trail. And we're going, following the stream out. And we can distinctly hear the sound of big, heavy footsteps in the stream, which was only about a foot and a half deep. But you could hear it plopping in the water. You know, and it was like dropping a bucket of rocks into a bunch of water. One footprint after the other. We could hear it. It was right behind us. It was within 20 feet. It was like right there, but we couldn't see anything. It was the weirdest thing I've ever encountered. You know, it bothered me ever since. You know, what the hell was that? Now, Native American tradition would tell you that they can be invisible sometimes, which I respect Native American traditions, and I love primitive culture, but I have a hard time rationalizing that. Accepting it as
right.
people, you know, it's things like that that cause me to consider these things a little bit more deeply and say, well, are they speaking literally about this? Maybe that isn't a metaphor for stealth. Maybe they mean it. Maybe they can be invisible. We don't know what a Bigfoot is. Most Bigfoot
That's
researchers
true.
Out there like to think they do, but they're a bunch of idiots. They don't. And if they're honest, they're the first ones to admit, we don't know what this is. All we have is theories and ideas and things of that nature, but we have nothing to support those theories and ideas.
Ooh.
You know, and the community is just too undisciplined to really, truly, critically look at all the possible evidence and all the possible information and then make a judgment of what you think it is or isn't. But you don't start a field of study. You don't start studying UFOs thinking UFOs are from outer space. See, you've answered the question and then you ask it. That's not how you do it. You ask a question and then you look for the answer. You don't come up with the
right
answer first. That's what the Bigfoot community
yeah.
has done.
So the short of this story is that y'all did finally get out alive, thank God, and you don't know now in retrospect if it really was Bigfoot or not that was stalking
right.
you.
Right, 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 absolutely. We know it's a Bigfoot area, but that doesn't automatically, we shouldn't, a disciplined critical mind doesn't automatically presume. See, most Bigfoot
right.
researchers would tell you, that was a Bigfoot. I can't say that because unless I see it right there, I don't know. And if I try
yeah.
anything else, that's not honest. not
so we're
going
to get back. Now we'll go back to the case in Michigan. We'll see, you know, the kind of similarity here that, and how now you can think back. You might have had a very close call with this phenomenon of the missing persons.
Right,
yeah.
right. When I first started getting, you know, briefed on the whole Blondie's thing, and started listening to the radio shows and looking at articles and books and things and really saying, wow, there's something really weird going on here. That last expedition of ours keeps, that's like the first thing that pops in my mind. You know, I mean,
uh-huh.
were we potential victims? You know, I mean, literally we could have all four vanished out there. No one would have known anything. There's nothing going out there. And on our way out, once we got out of the tree line, right, something
uh-huh.
in there started barking at us.
Barking?
Yep, and it sounded just like a Bigfoot bark. They got this little rah kind of noise, you know what I mean? And it was, I've heard this many times, you know what I mean? That, I can say, I think was a Bigfoot because it sounded just like one. But I don't know if that was what was stalking us.
Oh.
As soon as we came out of the tree line, it was maybe 25 yards away from us. Couldn't see it at
uh-huh.
all, but we could hear it clear as day, you know, and it sounded like it was agitated, like it was,
uh-huh.
you know, kind of a you kids get out of my lawn kind of thing, you know what
yeah.
I mean? It's
yeah.
a little bit irritated. And the worst aspect of it is the drizzling rain. We couldn't get it on tape. It was right there. We could hear it clear as day, but the tape recorder wouldn't pick it up because all the noise that the rain on the leaves and everything was making.
Goodness.
Same thing with Tennessee. In Tennessee, we couldn't record the Bigfoot. They were chattering out there all the time. We could hear them every night. But we couldn't record it because Tennessee has got down the biggest population of bugs I've ever heard of in my life. And it's like listening to a highway. I mean, you can hardly hear yourself think. The noise from the insects is just amazing. But yeah, so
wow. yeah,
now I look at things like Michigan thing, you know, and, you know, it really makes you wonder. We don't go back into that area. We're right now, we've kind of put a lockdown on it. I've been studying this area for over a decade. And, you know, now I feel that it's not,
oh
it would be
goodness.
Reckless for us to go back into this area at this point in time until we have a little bit more of a grip of what we're really
oh.
doing. Because if this is in those, in that borderland where the activity is taking place, then, you know, we have to consider, is it worth the risk? And definitely we're not going to be taking anybody else out there with us, you know, because we totally believe we don't want to be responsible for anybody getting hurt. And we don't want to
right.
we don't want to have to deal with ourselves getting hurt. But when you go out into an area like that, you are intelligently making that choice and saying, yes, I'm willing to take the risk. I could be killed, but I'm willing to do it, right? When you take people with you, they're counting on your guidance. You know?
Yeah.
Anybody that,
yeah.
that if
okay.
we go back into this area, anybody that comes with us is going to have the full Pilates briefing and and let them know that, you know, this is very serious. And, you know, we may never come back. We may disappear. We may fall prey to whatever this is, you know.
Well, let's get back to the Michigan case where we left off now, and because it gets very spooky.
Yeah, Cullen Finnerty, he was found 2 days after they lost contact with him, about a mile away from where they found his canoe. And where they found his canoe, one of the oars was missing. Outside of that, appeared to be normal. This is also another rare instance where David Pilates says that they have actually given him the case. They gave him the case file. So he's got the police and law enforcement and rescue data. All the original file on this. The crime scene photos, the whole nine yards. Lab reports. Apparently he had a prescription drug in his system, but it was nothing out of the ordinary. I don't think that could attribute to a person hallucinating or a person's death. You know,
a prescription drug,
you could have an adverse reaction, but I'm presuming this was a drug that he didn't just start that day. You know, normally if you're taking a drug you've never taken before and it kills you, it's usually when you first start taking it. You know, it's not.
Oh, yes.
Now, Joe, you said that he was in communication on his cell phone for almost a couple of hours before his battery died out on him.
Yeah.
You had told me that yesterday and the day before.
Yeah, and he had mentioned, as I said, he had mentioned that he was being pursued.
By what?
No one knows.
Go on with the story there. We'll speculate later about what was pursuing him, okay?
Okay.
There's also a conundrum with that. You know, regardless of what he said, you almost would have to hear it, you know, or have to talk to the person that was talking to him and get them to describe tones and things like this to you. But I'm sure both of you guys are familiar with the famous, I think it's Washington State, 9/11 emergency calls of a guy with a Bigfoot problem in his yard. Have you heard that?
No.
No.
Bigfoot people have heard this. You can just go online, go onto YouTube, look up Bigfoot 911 call, boom, you'll have it. This was two calls that was retrieved by Ron Moorhead in one of his investigations, and he obtained, you know, because 911 emergency calls are public, that's public domain. A lot of people, whether you know it or not, you have the right to go in and say, hey, I want to listen to this, and they got to give it to you, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's public property. Our money pays for it, so it's ours. The first call is this guy calling 911, and he's saying, something just killed my dog. I don't know what it was or what it was, but my dog got all upset, ran out into the woods. Next thing I know, the dog is flying 20 feet through the air across the yard, dead. And he was dead in the air, right? So something killed my dog, then threw it into my yard. And that's what he called them to complain about. And then a day or so later, the guy calls 911 again, and this time it's at night, and he's got this Sasquatch right there in his yard. He's in his house. He's looking at this thing.
A Cyclops?
No, Sasquatch.
Oh, Sasquatch. I thought you said a Cyclops.
No,
and no.
One-eyed Sasquatch. Who knows? When you listen to this, the first thing that stands out to me is how hard this man struggles to not tell the operator what he's looking at. Because, you know, they're asking questions. They want to keep you on the line, you know, because they're trying to face the call, for one. But they're trying to keep you from putting yourself in harm's way. And it also keeps the line of communication so that, to some degree, they know what's happening. So that's what they're trying to do, keep you on the line and then ask preliminary questions that they're typing into a computer that the responding officers are seeing on their computer in the squad car. So if you're describing an assailant that's 200 pounds and he's wielding a butcher knife, you know, they're typing that in so that before the officer arrives, he sees that on his monitor and he knows he's going to be dealing with a guy with a butcher knife, you know.
That's
how 911 operated, and she's asking him all these questions, you know, what color is he? you know? And he's like, well, he's black. Well, he's a black man? Well, no, he's just black. You know what I mean? He's struggling. You get the impression that this man is afraid that if he tells these people what he's looking at, they're not going to come. That was
right. Yes.
Seriously, look that up on YouTube, Bigfoot 911 recording, or you can go to Ron Moorhead's website and order his Bigfoot audio CDs. It's the two CD set. Fantastic deal. They're cheap as hell, and it's some of the best recordings you'll ever hear in your life that are authenticated. He's got that like just at the tail end of the second CD. And
let's get back to the condition of the man's body in Michigan. This is of interest here.
Well, that's another curious aspect. Pilates says that there was blood coming out of his nose, which can be typical of just death, just post-mortem, right?
Uh-huh.
It also could be typical of a hemorrhage, an internal hemorrhage, like a burst ventricle or something like this. There's a handful of things that might indicate, but outside of that, there was no injury to the body on the exterior level. None.
Mm-hmm.
And he was found face down. And the waders that he was wearing were disheveled and twisted. And Pilates,
and you said that,
according to the witnesses, well, I guess not according to the witnesses, according to the crime scene photos that he's looking at of the body, it kind of looks like something had picked him up by the suspenders of his gear on the back. And that's what made the twist. Something picked him up and carried him and then set the body down in a specific spot where it was found.
And
the pressure on that strap.
Now, you said that somebody's clothes, they had been undressed and redressed or something. What happened there?
Well, that's. I don't think that's apparent in this case, but it's apparent in many of these cases. And that's, you know, again, we're talking about a mystery that goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's just that modern Western man is just now rediscovering it.
Oh.
When you really look at it, this is really no different than the fairy lore. Fairies and elves and all these old mythologies, they all say the same thing, you know, and say that these things live in trees, they live in boulders, and they take people, you know, and some people come back, most people never do, and some come back and they're dead, you know, and there's a whole mythology about fairy lore and what they used to call the gentry, this race of little people that lived in the earth and controlled the world in a very bizarre, obtrusive way.
It sounds like Findhorn.
Yeah. And it's really, I mean, I don't know why the UFO community and all these different paranormal communities don't look at these things. Because, you know, John Keel first mentioned the parallels between fairy mythology and UFOs, 66 or 68, in an article that he had written. And nobody listened to it. Nobody. It's just terrible. You know.
Oh, my God.
And not a damn person even realized it at the time. And then that led to Dr. Jacques Vallée, of course, making a study of it.
Uh-huh.
He is curious enough. He did what John Keel intended the article to do. Hey, why don't you guys out there, instead of doing the same thing everybody else is doing, why don't one of you guys out there take this idea and go look for this and focus on it? You know, because a person like Keel, of course, he's got his teeth at the time sunk into the Mothman thing that was going on. So he didn't really have too much time in those days to follow that idea up, you know. But I've said the same thing. I had discovered a science journal from the 40s that talked about an anthropologist who was documenting native lore back in the 1860s. And his name was Myron Angel. And he collected from all the tribes in the Sierra region, he collected their oral traditions about the giant hairy Indians.
Oh!
In 1860, there was a man collecting information from Native American tribes about giant, cannibalistic, hairy Indians. This man was the first Bigfoot researcher.
Wow. Joe, we only got about 10 minutes left. I want to at least give a chance for some of my listeners maybe to call in with a question. We got about 10 minutes left. The show really has grown fast tonight. If you want to call us, call us.
Another one that comes with higher discoveries.
You want to open up and have a caller at this point, maybe?
Yeah, sure, certainly.
Okay, you can call us at 347-838-9142. That's 347-838-9142 if you want to ask a question of our guest tonight.
I think
we could go on for hours. I know you could go on for hours with all the knowledge you have on this subject. This mystery is quite alarming, and it's widespread.
The mainstream keeps going over the same things over and over and over again when, I mean, to me, this kind of stuff is so stimulating in so many different directions, you know, that it demands that you explore it instead of just rehash the same old stuff, you know what I mean? I've been telling people for years that there's so many weird things that go on that you just can't even imagine it. And
that's true.
You know,
yeah.
Things like this bizarre disappearances, you know, just in the domestic world, there is 2,000 children in the United States of America vanish. This is FBI posted statistics. Vanish.
Okay, we have two callers with a question.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a caller. Okay.
Is Ron?
Yes, this is Ron.
Howdy, Ron.
From Texas. I walked into the storyline very, very late, about minutes ago, so perhaps you've already addressed it, but I was wondering if there is much evidence that some of these disappearances could be something involving high technology, where the people simply walk to a certain spot and are lifted into a place where they just leave no more tracks, particularly in the New Mexican area.
Much like a... You know, I mean, I hate to cast a personality or a face to it, right? But my own personal observances in these cases is it's very reminiscent of a serial killer. You know what I mean? I'm not saying the phenomenon is the result of a serial killer. I'm saying that it has the same mentality because it demonstrates that it could take people without leaving a trace, yet it chooses to leave traces. Just to tease.
Most
of the evidence found is left in obvious places as if intended for someone to find it. Pardon me?
You were originally addressing, when I began hearing, the subject of Bigfoot, which is obviously some form of intelligent creature, but it would be a clumsy creature in certain ways. When you talk about something that
we can't really predict,
you could be talking about an alien species. And so I was wondering if there's much evidence of alien intervention there.
Well, if it's unfamiliar, it's alien. So if it's Bigfoot, if it's an unknown psychopath, if it's some paranormal phantasm from beyond the fourth dimension, it's all alien. That's all alien means. Unfortunately, because of media, the public tends to, they've made an icon of the word alien. So most people, they hear the word alien and their brain registers being from another planet. That is not so. Alien, by definition, just means foreign. Foreign to you. Unknown. You know, unfamiliar. That's all it means. Kind of like a cult. A lot of people think occultism means Satanism. It does not. It doesn't mean demonology. It doesn't mean any of these things. It means unknown. That's the Latin word, occult. Unknown. So if you are in occult studies, you study the unknown.
Is there evidence that this unknown is using a technology that would pick people up rather than being a Bigfoot that walks up and grabs someone?
Well, I don't think it's a Bigfoot that walks up and grabs somebody. I haven't seen any evidence yet that it's a UFO that's snatching people up or anything of the like. But whatever it is, it's happening in areas where things like that are more frequent. Like that is seen more often in these areas. So just like you have a space of land that has UFOs go over it a lot, and just that space of land might have a few haunted houses on it. You know, it's like there's a window there. There's something about our physics, our topographic and geographic physics,
and the fabric of our very reality, really, I think is what this comes down to. Because basically what is happening here is simply not possible, yet there it is. We can't deny that it's happening. These aren't stories of people seeing things in the sky or big hairy guys in the woods. These are things that are heavily investigated by law enforcement, and there's a wake of dead people behind it. You know what I mean? So that moves it completely into a different ballpark as far as the serious nature of the phenomenon. Nobody's making a hobby of this. You know what I mean? This is very serious, and no one's cracking the wise jokes that they usually crack when you're trying to explain impossible physics concerning ghosts, poltergeists, Bigfoot, Phantom Panthers, and UFOs. You know, all of these things, all paranormal manifestations, all have a certain key feature, a list of behavioral patterns that is identical, telling us that whatever the paranormal element is, it must be an element, because all of these things are really the same thing. They behave the same way. They have the same effects. And one of those effects is the demonstration of impossible physics. Bigfoot's footprints disappearing into nowhere. UFOs moving at 26,000 miles. That is so not physically possible. Not in our atmosphere. There's nothing we could build like that, you know. We just couldn't even withstand something like that. You know, so that to me, that's what really thrusts the missing persons problem into the paranormal realm, is the fact that it repeatedly demonstrates physics that just isn't possible.
Uh-huh.
Yet there it is. And it
doesn't
matter
if it
leads to our understanding of physics or not. We got to live with it. You know, we don't have a choice with it. It's imposing.
Yeah. One other weird thing, Joe, I want you to mention before we have to go off the air, the connection with young children visiting their grandparents and then disappearing and with this criteria that Pilates has documented.
Well, there's a whole handful of different sets of scenarios, elements that are involved in each case, right? And some are involved in most cases, some are involved in some cases, and some have like an uncanny pattern to them. It keeps repeating itself, even though there's no logical fitting of the two pieces together. Why would this be an element? And one of those things is a child visiting their grandparents in a rural area.
Ew.
Scenario happens like the weather over and over and over again. A kid visiting grandparents out at the farm. It just keeps repeating itself. And now we call that a signal. That's what you, when you're examining data, you're studying this stuff. That's all you should be gathering, right? You can contemplate after you've investigated, after you've looked at all the facts. But most people contemplate and theorize before they look at the facts. Again, you see how the general public at large does this, and they're thinking in reverse, and that's why it's not effective. You've got to look at all the establishable facts and then just look at those facts and what those facts imply and the possibilities they imply. But there's a distinctive pattern, kids visiting their grandparents and then suddenly vanishing. You know, and, you know, this Michigan case disturbs me greatly because I'm from Michigan. I got a lot of family and friends in Michigan, and I don't hunt. I don't believe in killing anything that isn't trying to kill me. That's my policy. But, you know, more power to you if that's your lifestyle. It's a big thing in Michigan. People hunt. It's a big, very popular thing. It's a very cultural thing. And, you know, the first thing I did when I saw this report was I forwarded it on to all my family members, most of which don't believe in Bigfoot, UFOs, and the paranormal, by the way. Right?
Uh-huh.
But I tell them, you know, stay out of this area. All of them know what to do if they run into a Bigfoot, whether they believe in Bigfoot or not. I've made sure of that, you know, because these guys will be out there with guns, you know, and you don't want to have a gun in your hands when you're confronted by a Bigfoot. But I sent the case to them and just said, you know, look this over, listen to this interview with Pilates. You know, this is a real phenomenon. Be careful and stay out of this area. Because it's
yeah.
no good. You know, if you avoid those areas, you greatly lessen your chances of this thing, whatever it is, happening to you.
Where's the most likely place?
Go ahead.
No, Eddie, I was just wondering what places are where the stuff happens the most. Is it Michigan or what?
Yeah.
Oh, all over the United States. Okay.
I believe it happens all over the world as far as what it's looking like at the moment. But I believe, according to Pilates 411 team, the group of people that he has studying this stuff and investigating it, they put together a map. But I believe Texas and Pennsylvania, it seems like the entire state of Pennsylvania is haunted to all get out. And apparently it's always been that way. If you like paranormal stuff, that is the place to go. Go hang out with Stan Gordon in Pennsylvania. Allison Cruz is somebody I know on Facebook that is doing some amazing UFO work. Look that stuff up on YouTube and check it out. But these people are getting clear footage of, you know, almost nightly visitations in the woods behind their property of UFOs.
We're running out of time now, so thanks again for being on. It's just totally intriguing information and quite unsettling, really, to soberly contemplate. Thanks again for being on Night Search. You've been listening to our typical outrageous information, and it's all true, folks. Good night.
Yep, good night.